Good afternoon. Convening State Affairs at 3:01 p.m. on Tuesday, February 14th in the Max Grunberg, Alaska House of Representatives Judiciary Room here in the Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Tuck? Representative Josephson?
Here.
Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wolf. Representative Kopp. Representative Ledoux. Chair Christ Tompkins.
Here.
Johnson, here.
and Representative Tuck arriving also here right at the roll call. And Representative Ledoux is gone this week. Her grandson Bjorn is being born, and Representative Tuck is serving as vice chair for the duration of this week, and Representative Josephson filling in as an alternate. We have a quorum with now six members present, and we'd like to thank Martha, the secretary, and Matt Kern, the LAO, keeping things running telephonically and otherwise. Please silence any cell phones, and a reminder that we have the Finance Subcommittee immediately succeeding this committee, convening theoretically at 4:30, and we'll do our best to honor that to the minute. And we have two items on today's agenda. The first, House Bill 91, APOC registration fees and lobbyist tax, although I'm not sure if the last word is still going to be applicable given committee discussion, but I guess we'll find that out soon. And also House Bill 3, Representative Tuck's bill, relating to National Guard leave and reemployment rights, which will be the first time we've heard this bill. It's my hope that with both bills we'll take public testimony. And first on the agenda is House Bill 91, APOC registration fees and lobbyist tax. And I think maybe start off an open public testimony and go from there. And I am looking, and there's no one online. Opening public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, closing public testimony. I know there's at least one lobbyist in this building who's expressed to me an interest in testifying, but we can always reopen public testimony another day to accommodate any such desire. I guess at this time, there was quite a bit of discussion and commentary. I'd maybe invite the sponsor and presenter up to the table to see if there's further thoughts from the sponsor in terms of the direction the bill might be going and or questions from the committee.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Sam Keto, District 33, Northern Southeast, and Crystal Heeneman, my staff is here with me today. I will say from the testimony and the questions that were brought forward in the previous meeting on House Bill 91, we have undertaken a very concerted effort to look at what we're trying to accomplish and see if there's a slightly different way to accomplish that, and looking forward to working with the committee chair's staff to make a few changes to the bill. One of the changes and one of the things that was highlighted to me regarding the actual lobbyist tax component is that there is not a way to clearly identify that the lobbyist tax revenue will directly benefit the Alaska Public Offices Commission. So we are going to look at a way that maybe we can generate revenue and still have that revenue go and support Alaska Public Offices Commission. And then there are a few other tweaks that we think would actually make the bill a little bit better, and I'll let Ms. Keeneman talk a little bit about some of the things that have been discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Keeneman, staff to Representative Keto. As Representative Keto mentioned, the discussion of whether this is a tax or a fee was kind of highlighted at the last meeting and subsequent conversations following that hearing. And so it's a matter of where we go from here and how to, one, generate enough revenue to help offset some of the general fund dollars associated with APOC, whether that's a solitary fee or whether it's a stair-stepping of fees. And so I know that's one of the parts that we're looking for an upcoming CS. Additionally, there is some suggestions from the from APOC, and I believe Heather is online if you want a little more clarity on those. In the bill, it discusses candidates, groups, and non-group entities that are required to file these reports with APOC. There's some additional groups, such as labor unions, corporations, and other individuals that may be excluded if we just use those, the candidate, the groups, and the non-group entities. And so APOC has, one of their suggestions is to broaden that to the word persons, so that way they can ensure that they encapsulate those. One of the other questions that arose was with candidates filing. A lot of times the candidates file for office more than 12 months in advance of the election cycle. And so it would be broadening that language to incorporate the candidates' registration for the full election cycle instead of just for a 12-month cycle. Additionally, there is some language that's not addressed for civil penalties for non-payment of registration fees for filers that was inadvertently left off. It's included in one section of the bill, but it wasn't in a second piece, so just for standardization and clarity to have something along those lines. And and with that, Mr. Chairman, those are that's kind of the direction that we're looking at with the potential CS. Again, you know, Representative Birch, you had some good comments, and you know, we want to ensure that we're listening to the committee and taking in all of the questions and concerns that were raised to come up with the best bill possible.
Thank you, Representative Keto and Ms. Kinnaman, for the inclusive, iterative approach. I think that's representative of the ideals of the committee process. I mean, with in mind that this is moving, further comments from the committee, Representative Birch?
Yeah, I still want to steer away from an income tax. As proposed here, it says pay a tax of 2.5% of the person's income earned on page 4 of the in the sponsor statement and in the draft. And I guess I have a real concern about basically leveling this out or setting this out as an income tax. I would be much more comfortable to retain some sort of a flat rate. I think we had some discussion about maybe it's $500 per lobbyist, and then there's some discussion about whether it's per lobbyist or per client, and however that gets sorted out, I think that's a much more manageable approach than instituting an income tax on the lobbyists based on their revenue, and certainly more consistent with what I would see as fair and equitable. Thank you.
Further comments or questions in the committee, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry for being late, and maybe this came up already, but we asked last time, we knew that there was 500 clients. Did we get a number back about how many lobbyists there are?
Great question. I had actually just scribbled that down myself. Ms. Hebden, I believe that came up in questions from the last committee hearing. Do you now have a definitive number of registered lobbyists who receive payment for service, those who register with APOC?
Yes, Heather Hebden with APOC through the chair, Representative Wool. The actual five-year average comes out to about 132 registered lobbyists in a year. I've provided Ms. Koneman with the actual numbers from 2012 through 2016, so she should have those as well.
Thank you.
Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's funny that we're looking at adding in persons, when persons is one of the reasons why we have Citizens United, because there has been case law that's determined that under persons, it doesn't differentiate. The courts haven't differentiated between natural beings and artificial beings. Therefore, corporations have First Amendment rights in their ability to be able to use their general funds for unlimited contributions on issues. And so I just think it's kind of funny that we have to potentially go into persons again. And that's something that's going to have to be fixed in a different way, but I understand why we need to do it in this situation. When we look at the burden on Alaska Public Offices Commission to oversee the finances of the lobbyists and looking at the meals that they're providing for people, the events that they have and everything else, it actually makes sense that we have a fee structure that's based on revenue, because there's going to be more oversight on those larger revenue streams, especially with all the events and everything that they have going on, than there would be for a smaller group of people doing just having someone come in and talk to people. So to me, the fee structure based on revenue makes a lot of sense.
Representative Birch.
Yeah, just one of the questions that had come up at our last session was on the analysis. It showed a revenue estimate. This is page 2 of 2 on the backup here, and it said the revenue estimate was average of $16.9 million in APOC reports total fees paid to lobbyists. Paid to lobbyists was almost $17 million, and a 2.5% tax on that generated $425,000 in annual revenue. But if you look at the sponsor statement in the bottom, it had a $244,000, which is about half of what the number in the back. So I guess trying to understand which of those is accurate. And again, if you're looking at 120 or 130 lobbyists at a couple thousand apiece, you generate the you'd generate an amount similar to what's proposed here. So just but maybe the sponsor can give some clarity to the difference in the two numbers.
Representative Kito.
To the chair, Representative Birch, and there are two components to that answer. One is that when we did the sponsor statement, we had some information that was provided to us by the Alaska Public Offices Commission about a year and a half ago, so dated information. Department of Revenue utilized current information to come up with their estimate. The other component of the question is that the Department of Revenue, with their $425,000 estimate, does not acknowledge that the existing lobbying fee will be removed, which is about $106,000. So you take $106,000 away from the $425,000, and we're at about $380,000, I think, which is adjusted for the new or the updated Alaska Public Offices Commission numbers. There will be a revised sponsor statement when we have a committee substitute, and that will explain the numbers, and they will be much more clear.
Fair enough. Thank you, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Bishop. I think that was an outstanding question from last time. Representative Knott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Kito, I understand what you're trying to do, on this, and that's to make an agency generate revenue to pay for what we've asked them to do. I think my problem, not just with this particular bill, but through this whole subcommittee process, is that at some point in time, it's kind of our responsibility to look at how our departments conduct their business. And I can say, sir, that in this whole budget subcommittee process, we've always looked at raising revenue or fees, and we've not once yet dug in the details of how they do their business and should we modify that. We've never had that discussion. We haven't taken a balanced approach to this budget process. So in that, my problem with the bill and putting more fees on, if you've served at municipal level for any amount of time, you realize how hard it is to get even candidates who aren't filing but who are appointed boards, commissions, having to do APOC reports. The APOC filing in themselves discourages a lot of candidates, and now you put a fee on top of that, you're going to discourage even more. That is a problem with local municipal governments, boards, commissions. And so when I look at the sponsor statement, and you noted in there that their budget's reduced in FY15 from 1.3 to 866,000 in 16, but that was solely for that year, and in subsequent years they've always been funded at $1 million, $33,000, and this year $1,050,000 in the governor's budget. So, you know, I don't see, I mean, it was a drastic cut in the 1 year, but we're kind of back. So for me to support the bill, I really need to have the discussion about, and not just this particular agency or department, but pretty much all of them I'm involved in, about how we conduct our business and should we take a more balanced approach to looking at the budget. And so my question for you, Representative, is since I'm new and you've been here a while, have them discussions happened? Have we taken a look at that? I know there's been reductions over time, but I don't see it reflected in the numbers recently.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the biggest issue that we have is the budget was reduced. The agency was struggling with trying to meet their statutory obligations, and they still are. The legislature authorized additional program receipts, so that is actually that amount of the budget that we see going back up to what the legislature acknowledged was an appropriate level for the budget. But the agency did not have the ability to collect the receipts in excess of the $106,000 that they already have the authorization for. So they are leaving over $100,000 on the table because they don't have a mechanism to collect the revenue to get to that budget item, which was the primary motivation for me looking at this piece of legislation. Secondary motivation was the lobbying reporting office in Juneau was substantially reduced through the budget reduction process, and I do believe that we are not meeting our statutory obligations in making sure that we've got adequate oversight of lobbying activities because of the reduction in staff for the lobbying side of the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you for that, Representative. So, and then the other concern that Representative on my far right just brought up is about the additional oversight of APOC in lobbying reporting. You know, it's been a snowballing effect into a lot of our boards and commissions, if we've seen in hearings about how they're underfunded in investigative costs or overriding. And I'm somewhat concerned that we're going to get in the same thing here with additional oversight. I guess I'm afraid of the snowball effect. We implement it. We figure out that there's much more work to do, much more investigative costs, oversight of lobbyists and others, and then fees will continue to escalate. I'm not any concerns about that. We're going to have to modify this in the near future again.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the Alaska Public Offices Commission operated at a fairly stable staffing level for quite a long time before reductions put pressure on their ability to do some of the audits. Our effort is to allow them to be able to do their work. I do not see the ability for the agency to grow without control. I do see that the legislature will be reviewing the budget through Department of Administration annually to determine whether or not they are performing that function for the state of Alaska. The legislature also has the ability through the legislative audit function to assign an audit of the agency or of the division to determine whether or not they are performing the statutorily designated function. I do think that those things can still happen, and I do think that it's a good idea to actually allow them to collect receipts to get to the point where we've told them they could, and then I also think it's a good idea for them to be able to have some more support in the lobbying reporting side.
Thank you.
And running with one of your questions, Representative Kito, jump in here. What in your mind is adequate oversight of lobbying activities? I mean, you referenced that you're not sure that there is adequate, that APOC is able to fulfill its statutory obligations. And I'm interested in what you see as that sort of gap or delta between what should be happening and what actually is happening right now.
My perspective at this point, Chair Christ-Tompkins, is that we would be able to hire a professional level position, an individual that will be able to understand, interpret statute, and provide advice to lobbyists as they're filing reports. Right now, we do have a competent individual, but at the level of a clerk and not at the level of a professional individual who has a good interpretive understanding of the lobbyist statutes.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that you've taken a look at some of this and know that, I mean, apparently have decided that you might have to re-look at it to get it to just because of the designated funds, because that was a question that I had. But I guess the two things. One is having worked on the oil tax or beginning to work on the oil tax, the nature of things being all over the place, I guess I see that beginning here. If we are going to do an income tax, well, then we'll do an income tax, I guess. Hope not, but that might happen. But I think if we start to embed things in different pieces of the code or the law, statute, I guess I have some concern for simplicity. And so did you see this expanding to other professions? That was my main question.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that the lobbying profession regulated under APOC is a unique function and is not related to other professions that are regulated under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Those licensing activities and those investigations under the Department of Commerce are already required to pay their own way, and those fees are adjusted every other year for those professions. And so all of the activities that are associated with those boards are paid for by those licensees or registrants. The Alaska Public Offices Commission has been supported by general fund revenue and a $250 per client fee, which has generated a little over $100,000 historically. So there has not been anything that requires that the Alaska Public Offices Commission operate based entirely on the professions that they regulate. And the fees, in my opinion, would become very high if we required them to do that, which is why this is really designated or identified to try and just adjust to that level of program receipts that were authorized by the legislature, plus a desire to have better oversight in the lobbying office. So we could start looking at this like we look at other professions and try and have them pay their own way. Those costs might end up quite a bit higher than they would be in this bill.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I got a few questions. They might be unrelated, but just to refresh my memory, the $50 financial disclosure fee, and what is that currently?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, there is not currently a fee for the financial disclosure reporting.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair.
The
$100 candidate fee, that's currently $30. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, there is not currently an Alaska Public Offices candidate fee, so that is a new $100 for filing for candidacy.
Follow-up?
Thanks. And so, and if this was to resemble what another board would be for a professional board and licensing structure like we've looked at before, if you had a board with 132 people, not a board with 132 people, but a professional group with 132 members, similar to, say, the board of, I don't know, optometrists or something like that. In other words, they fund, they're sort of self-funded, as has been discussed. And their fees cover all sorts of things, including possible investigations. But the APOC sort of expense would be a lot higher, I would imagine, because it's sort of like an ongoing investigation at all times. I mean, there's always someone doing APOC work, where the other boards, it's when they're requested, if in case they think there's a violation. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I'm not completely sure I'm following your line of question, but I do have a thought regarding the situation. I don't believe that there is a way to
realistically compare the oversight function of Alaska Public Offices Commission with the regulation or licensing function with the Division of Corporations Business Licensing and Business Licensing or Professional Licensing. And the reason I say that is that there are two components to Alaska Public Offices Commission activity. One is the lobbying side of things, where there are 132 lobbyists representing 400 and some clients accessing the legislature. And then there is the other side, which are all of the candidates that apply to run for political office. And they are regulated and overseen by another side of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. With all of the candidates and groups filing registrations, the estimated revenue is less than $20,000 for that activity. So we would not be able to collect enough revenue on the candidate side of things to pay for the APOC candidate review side of that. So that's going to, I would suggest, still be supported by general fund activities, but we do have an opportunity to have lobbying activities cover some more of their reporting requirements, because it's a paid profession that individuals receive revenue from. We have that opportunity to utilize some of that revenue to help support the commission.
Okay, thanks. And there is one person who's come in for public testimony, and given that it was noticed today, I'm thinking of maybe going to that, and we can circle back for any final questions before perhaps moving on to the next piece of legislation in light of the fact that there's a forthcoming committee substitute. So reopening public testimony. Online from rural Deltana, Pam Good. Pam, if you can hear me, please identify yourself and state your affiliation and present your testimony.
I'm Pam Good, and I'm presenting, and I'm from rural Deltana. I'm glad to see that there's changes going on with this bill. I do oppose it. I would appreciate if you just stick it in a desk drawer and get rid of it, or basically change the whole thing so that it downsizes APOC. APOC has a very, very, very bad reputation with anybody who wants to run for office. And they say that they were never supposed to do anything to deter people from participating in their government. And I can tell you right now, good people don't run for office because of what APOC does. And when they were first created back in 1976, there were no computers. They're a huge violation of Article 1, Section 22. They make you provide data that you do not even have to give to the IRS. The IRS is just salivating over the data that they take, and then they put it on the World Wide Web. That's not public information when it goes on the World Wide Web. China and people in Texas have no business knowing half the stuff that they collect, and I'm probably speaking on behalf of a lot of people in there, because you have had to file these exact things. And I will tell you this, the reason APOC is overloaded is because they do petty things. I have had to call them myself on just something very simple and had to eat up a day or more of their time on something that is extremely petty. And as far as when they do their auditing that they do, a lot of times it's on filings that are less than $100. So what I'm trying to point out here is oftentimes we look for ways to fund agencies, and what we need to start looking at is a way to release them of the pettiness so they can focus on what they're supposed to be doing, and that's going after the bad guys, not deterring people from participating. Commissioners, people running for office, they won't step up because of what's required with APOC. And I just wanted to share that with you guys, because I don't know if you've taken that angle. They are offensive to the people who run. And a lot of people out there have no idea what APOC is or what they do because they don't run for office. But the first time you run for office, your jaw will hit the floor. My husband actually said, you're not running for office because of what they're doing. But in order for me to do the right thing and to stand up for what I'm seeing going on in the state, I went ahead and let them violate my privacy in order to do the right thing. So as you move forward with this bill, please take all that into consideration. That completes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Good. Are there any questions for Ms. Pam Good from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Pam, for making the time. I'm going to close public testimony once again. And I believe there may have been a last question from Representative Josephson or a series of questions, or from more than
sure, Representative really just a comment. And I'm sort of coming into this movie halfway through it. So I don't know a whole lot, although I was privy to it. I missed the hearing. But a couple thoughts, to the extent they help the body, are these. First of all, my own experience with AIPOC is not been unfavorable. I don't think my experience hasn't been that they're unreasonable. I mean, one could ask, for example, or quibble about if someone's retired, why do we care what they're retired from, and that sort of question. But those are very small matters. When I was on the floor last March, I was really alarmed about this budget, really, really alarmed. And I'm glad that some of it creatively got restored. But I just remember thinking it would be impossible for this agency to do its job, and we've set them up for failure. Couple other thoughts I wanted to share. There was a trial, I think last summer, before Judge Burgess of the Federal District Court about whether our limit of $500 personal contribution was constitutionally lawful. He found that it was. I think that's been appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and he may be overruled, if I'm right that it was appealed. And I'd only note that because the presence of money is only going to grow. We've seen with soft money that it's growing every cycle. I think it's important for the public to have the information they need. I will note one thing that strikes me as an attorney. I note this, and that is this candidate fee, which would be, I guess, $150, $100, and then perhaps $50 for the public official financial disclosure. One could find a situation where that was, you might need some waiver system in case there's a plea of poverty. It's probably not going to arise very often, but it could. And it occurs to me there's no way to raise that money because you'd be in violation of the law. You'd have to first register, then raise it, and you couldn't register without posting it. But I think given our fiscal situation, we need creative ways to fund budgets. And by the way, this whole predicament reminds me of the need for a fiscal plan. As I say every day in this building, with a fiscal plan, a lot of this could be solved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was some discussion about, I think we identified 130 lobbyists. Did we ever determine how many clients are actually funded? If we have about a $17 million in revenue reported by AIPOC in total fees paid to lobbyists, which I think we figured out that works out to about $266,000 per legislator. But how many clients are involved in this lobbying enterprise?
And Ms. Hebden, you're online. My recollection is a number a little bit north of 500 may have came up in the last hearing. But Ms. Hebden, do you have an answer to that question?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I do believe we discussed it briefly, and doing a brief calculation, I believe 480 was what we determined. That's based on the $250 registration fee per client, and that we generally raise about $120,000 per year.
Okay, if I might, by way of follow up, so a client, so somebody that wishes to be a client or get engaged pays a fee of $250. That's a question.
The lobbyist who they retain pays a $250 registration fee per client.
Follow up.
Okay, so it's Okay, so I'm $250 times 480 clients, and then the 130 lobbyists, do they pay something in addition to that, or is that just the actual revenue derived from the clients?
Correct.
Okay, so that's about 100. And, yeah, I got you. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wall.
Thank you. 2 points, but first to clarify what Representative Birch was asking. I believe she said it's a $250 fee per client per lobbyist. So if I'm a client and I hire four lobbyists, four times 250 gets paid. Okay. That's my understanding from what Ms. Hepton said. And maybe she'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it's per client per lobbyist, not each contract they get into with each individual lobbyist. And
that's my understanding as well. And Ms. Hepton, would you be able to confirm that understanding?
Yes, through the chair, that is correct.
Representative?
So, therefore, a larger client may hire multiple lobbyists. My other question is maybe general or maybe to Representative Keto, but if this isn't what we're going to call an income tax or a tax based on the income of a lobbyist, and let's suppose a larger income tax gets passed working towards a fiscal plan this session, is there concern that there's sort of double taxing going on, that people are paying, or I guess lobbyists in this case, would be paying in multiple different places?
Representative Keto?
For the record, Representative Keto, House District 33. And that is one of the complications, I think, of actually having a tax and then another tax. But the situation that a lobbyist will pay on the gross receipts of an amount, 2.5% of the gross, is independent of whether that lobbyist claims income from those activities and how much income that lobbyist claims, because most of the time those gross receipts end up being reduced by whatever factors the filer has for taxes. So that individual might receive revenues of $900,000 or $500,000, but their expenses, their tax status, other things might impact the actual taxes that person pays. So that question of calling it a lobbyist income tax is a question that we are actually working on in regard to a committee substitute, because we do want to avoid that that concern or perception of double taxation.
Okay, thank you.
I think at this time, perhaps wrap up this committee hearing. I would really encourage members, if you're interested in this legislation or would like to advocate it going in a certain direction, that you seek out the sponsor and have further conversations, especially with Ms. Kinnaman, who's very knowledgeable. We'll come back again with a committee substitute and go from there and see sort of where it is in terms of incorporating some of the thoughts that have come up in committee. A couple of housekeeping notes. Representative Wall joined us at 3:04 p.m. I failed to acknowledge that earlier. Thank you. And with Representative Josephson present today as an alternate, also want to note, if I didn't last time, that Representative Kopp, as opposed to Representative Knopp, is also an alternate on the committee as of the last Committee on Committees meeting. And it is my intent that we seat alternates when we have predictable absences, particularly those that may carry over several committee hearings. And if you're going to be out of town or know you're going to be out of town for a period of time, just flag me down and we can figure it out and make sure that we bring in either Representative Josephson or Representative Kopp and try to keep full membership of the committee to keep doing good work. At this time, I'd like to move to the next item on today's agenda, House Bill 3, sponsored by Representative Tuck. This is the second committee referral for House Bill 3 relating to National Guard leave and reemployment rights. It passed with flying colors in its first committee of referral, Military and Veterans Affairs. And I'm excited to hear it today. Representative Tuck, please present the bill and staff as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. For the record, I'm Representative Chris Tuck, and joining me with me is Kendra Klosser, staff to my office. I'm pleased to present House Bill 3. House Bill 3 simply allows for employment rights of employees of the state who are members of the National Guard of another state, territory, or district in the United States. So this does plan on correcting a deficiency in employment protections for Alaskans who are serving the National Guards across the nation. And this is a nationwide effort by the Department of Defense to ensure those who serve their nations for all 50 states when called to duty, regardless of their service location, will have reemployment rights to their Alaskan civilian job after completing the various critical activities when called by a governor for state active duty. So currently, the National Guard is a hybrid state-federal entity, and while the National Guard members are subject to federal call to duty by the President of the United States, they can also be pulled up for the state active duty by the governor to respond to state emergencies such as fires, tornadoes, and floods. So the federal law, which is the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, USERRA, protects members of the Army or Air National Guard when they are called from their civilian jobs for federal service. But however, USERRA does not apply when a National Guard member must leave their job for state active duty. If National Guard members are to have reemployment rights after state active duty, it must be through state law. And that's what we're hoping to do with this piece of legislation. And so currently, Alaska has a law that applies to employment protections to the public and private employees. However, it is explicitly limited to members of the Alaska National Guard. There are several Alaskan residents who serve in the National Guard of another state who do not have the reemployment protections for their employment. And so by passing House Bill 3, we will extend those employment protections to Alaskans who are serving in any National Guard. And the Department of Defense has identified this legislation as a key quality of life issue that is actively seeking to make this policy change across the nation. And so far, 28 states have passed similar legislation, and three states, including Alaska, is currently looking into it.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions. First off, there are Alaska residents who serve in the National Guard of another state. I can understand an Alaska resident serving in the Alaska National Guard. So I guess the first question would be maybe a little more description on a scenario where you'd have Alaska resident not serving in the Alaska National Guard. And then secondly, how many people does this impact?
Thank you, Representative Birch. We, through the chair, we have many Alaskan workers that live here in Alaska, raising their family here in Alaska, that happen to be Guard members from other state. And so if perhaps something happens in Idaho to where their Guard duty is and they have to get shipped over for a fire, for emergency, called by their governor in that state, then that person would be able to return back to Alaska with their employment, just as if they were called by the president and serve in National Guard duty overseas. And then on that, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the answer to how many people this may affect, but we definitely have, and I'll turn it over to my aide, Kendra Klosser.
Kendra Klosser, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. On that one right now, we do have the recent data that Department of Defense provided. We have 33 individuals in Alaska that are part of at least 19 other states' National Guards. And right now, that number is, it's self-reported at this point, so there definitely could be more. So it just depends on whether that's reported by the Guard members that they are here and serving in other states. So right now, we only have 33 that have actually reported, but there could be more.
Follow-up? Okay, for follow-up. So how does somebody happen to be in that circumstance? And I'm not entirely familiar with how that works, but if somebody, you know, lives out of state and is a member of the National Guard in, say, California, they move to Alaska and take a civilian employment job, but their National Guard is kind of on the side. Do they not then transfer that National Guard affiliation to Alaska? Or I don't understand why they'd have a disconnect in that situation.
And Representative Birch, through the chair, I do have Bob Dole on the line, a deputy commissioner, I believe, that can also speak to that, and he has a really good in-depth story, so I will defer to him, but I will say that there are members of other National Guards that do move to Alaska, and there is a process to get them involved into the Alaska National Guard. So during that time, if they're working on their process and they get called to duty during their time of changing, that could be one of the instances that could happen. But I do want to, I would like to refer that over to Bob Dole so he can give some specific circumstances, and he was involved in a similar situation where he can give a personal story on that.
Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Dole, did you hear the question, and can you identify yourself and state your affiliation for the record in answering?
For the record, Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the House State Affairs Committee. My name is Bob Dole. I am the Deputy Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, where Major General Hummel commands the Alaska National Guard on the governor's behalf. I am also a retired National Guard colonel with 3 decades of service in the Army and Air National Guard, Army Reserve, and active duty. The short version of how somebody ends up drilling in another state, I've done it 3 times in my career, is that your personal life or civilian professional personal life gets out of sync with your military career. This most often happens with students, military spouses, or a civilian career that requires frequent work outside, so affiliation outside is easier. It's also done for professional reasons. We're a small state. Sometimes we don't have the particular position someone is seeking. Yes, sir? Oh, sorry. So, for instance, if you started your military career flying F-15s or F-16s that we don't have up here or armor in the Army and want to stay in that career field, you would drill outside. It could also just be the time it takes to get into the Alaska National Guard. In my case, when I moved up here, that was about an 11-month process. It's also done for what we call professional development. If you're an Alaska Guardsman, because we're a small state, you may take an opportunity to serve outside in positions not available here, which will make you far more valuable to the Alaska National Guard once you come back. I'd like to tell you about 3 times in my life where my military career was out of sync with my personal life, for some examples. After graduating college, I moved to another state for a job while I continued to drill in my original state. After getting off active duty and finishing law school, I continued to affiliate with a reserve organization in the Midwest while living in Washington, D.C., so I could finish a command tour of a unit in transition for 2 years. And when moving to Alaska, I continued to travel to Newport News, Virginia to command a unit and maintain pilot proficiency, all in the process of transferring to the Alaska Air National Guard. The United States spent well into 6 figures training me as a military pilot and saved probably well into 5 figures by my maintaining pilot proficiency in another state while that process was occurring for me to join the Alaska Air National Guard. And I'd just like to add from a personal note, although cross-state affiliation may be common outside where you can drive across 3 states in an hour, the time, distance, and cost factors of an outside National Guard affiliation while living in Alaska highly incentivize finding a path into the Alaska National Guard up here. And that's why DMVA supports this bill as overall conducive to developing a professional militia in Alaska. It allows those that have moved it allows a continuity of service for those Alaskans whose life plans require them to move outside for a period. It also incentivizes new Alaskans to remain engaged with the military from a prior affiliation until we can get them on board up here. When they keep that participation going and their readiness is current, it simplifies our recruiting somebody who is already trained where the government has already spent possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars training them to do a mission for our nation and state. It also supports us developing a more capable force for Alaskans by enabling Alaskans to go outside for and affiliate outside for temporary periods for positions and not available up here. In short, Alaska may have a transient population, but we're confident we're going to gain or regain those Alaskans affiliated with another state's National Guard, given the challenges of outside affiliation. We support this bill because it increases their recruitability by avoiding breaks in service and their readiness when they do come to us, maintaining or increasing their ability to serve Alaskans in time of disaster and saving taxpayers the high cost of retraining or training a new recruit altogether. My apologies for any jargon that crept in there. I really tried to avoid it. I also realize this is a complex area, and I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
A follow-up from Representative Birch. I think I'll take you up on that.
Yes, thanks, Bob, and thanks so much for the tour last fall. It was very helpful, and appreciate the opportunity to get a look at everything you guys do. Just the follow-up might be, are there employers out there when somebody comes back from guard service out of the 33 reported folks that won't take their employee back? I guess that's a question.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, because there are no protections in place at this point, no one has brought to our attention this ever happening. In short, there's not a mechanism for us to address it. I'd note on the federal side, under the USERRA law, USERRA was a body of law that came in together that was necessary to protect guardsmen when mobilized for periods of service for federal duties. And if guardsmen were brought back, we wouldn't need that whole body of law. Also, although most state active duty is usually a really short duration, 2 or 3 days for a blizzard or a hurricane, if we look at like the post-Katrina cleanup, some of that state active duty lasts for months. And we recognize that it left some employers with a difficult decision to make, and kind of if not appreciating the need, the importance of the mission, it could result in adverse actions.
Okay, just by way of follow-up, thank you for that clarification. Then just to put my mind at ease, there's no one sitting out there, no guardsman that's coming back and being denied a job opportunity. This is forward-looking and preventative. It's not intended to address a current situation. Is that fair?
The chair, Representative Birch, that's correct. We're aware of no, this is meant to be proactive. We're aware of no adverse situation as we sit here.
Thank you. That concludes my questions.
Questions from other members of the committee? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question can go to either the presenters at the table or to Mr. Dole. Two questions. First, and maybe this is dating myself, but it used to be National Guard was thought of as one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. Is that still the formula? And if they're currently living in Alaska and a member of another state's National Guard, does that mean every one weekend a month they have to fly to their home state where they serve?
Through the chair, basically, this is Representative Chris Tuck, basically, yes, but I'll let Deputy Commissioner Dole expound on that.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, the bare minimum participation averages out to 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks of continuous training. I don't think we've had the bare minimum training done by a guardsman that minimal since 9/11. Generally, though, in my case, because of flight proficiency, it did require monthly and sometimes twice a month flights outside to maintain currency as a guardsman. Depending on the military occupational skill, some guardsmen are able to go out perhaps once a quarter for like 6 days to accomplish the blocks that way rather than go out monthly and save some of the time and extensive participation outside. I'd note, though, that is... there's already federal protections in place for those drill weekends and annual training. This bill is dealing with state active duty for specific disasters and state needs.
Thank you. Follow up, please. Yeah. So I'm trying to sort of distill down your statements earlier. But first of all, I didn't realize that there was so much specialized training for National Guard that maybe someone used a certain. Airplane or certain equipment that they may not be available in all the states. But what you also said, that if Alaska joins other states in allowing this protection for Alaskans that are members in other states' National Guard, it would actually potentially increase the number of people coming to Alaska and joining the National Guard here, as opposed to the opposite, which would be they'd maintain their membership in another state. So what you said is they might move here, keep their membership in another state, but while the transition is going on, then they could transfer into Alaska National Guard. Does that make sense, what I just said?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, basically these protections fill an important role for an individual to keep participating with an outside organization. When you start paying for the plane tickets out of your own pocket and losing a day, you have to address with a civilian employer on each side of a drill weekend. I can tell you firsthand that gets old pretty fast, and you're going to find a way to save the $1,000 a month in travel costs going outside to get yourself into the Alaska National Guard, if that's retraining altogether, crossing components, or something else. The travel cost and time incentivizes affiliating in Alaska, not to mention that it's the best place in the world to train.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? At this time, I'm going to open public testimony unless there's further comment from the sponsor. And we can, of course, circle back there. There's one testifier, it looks, unless there's anyone in the room. Mark Sansucci with the Department of Defense testifying from Lakewood, Washington. Mark, good to hear from you. Could you identify yourself and state your affiliation for the record and present your testimony?
Yes, good afternoon, Honorable Chair Christ-Tompkins and committee members. For the record, my name is Mark Sansucci, a retired Air Force officer, and I am the Department of Defense Regional State Liaison for the Northwest, including Alaska, working for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Military Community and Family Policy. You know, it's always great to follow the staff and Deputy Commissioner Dole, because I don't want to be redundant, and I've just been listening keenly and watching you and only want to add some value to this discussion. As stated, 28 states are already providing the protection that we seek here, and three other states are taking it up. An example might be that an Alaska resident who's a member of a National Guard in Washington State or Oregon might be called up for 30 days to fight, you know, a forest fire or something, and while that person is gone, if they were in private industry, maybe they're a barista somewhere, they maybe can get fired because they weren't around. They didn't have that protection, and that kind of thing is what the intent of this is, and those things have happened nationally in states enough to make this an issue that the Department of Defense made one of their key issues 3 years ago. If you could bear with me, when we talk about 33 people who were self-reported, as Kendra alluded to, there could be more of those. The way this data is collected, it's self-reporting, and some people can decide they don't want to divulge that information. But I can tell you, if you bear with me, that there are 19 states where Alaskans are members of other guardsmen for the reasons that Deputy Commissioner Dole has outlined, professional development, or they're in process of transferring. But they are actually in Alabama, Arkansas, California, Florida, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, North Carolina, North Dakota, Nevada, New York, Oregon, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Washington, and even West Virginia. So there are people in those other states currently serving, and for those reasons in transition or for career development, maybe sometimes they want to get to the next rank, and it's going to be more feasible if they stay in the state, one of these 19 states, than trying to find a slot in Alaska that they stay put, and they soak up those costs that Commissioner Dole refers to for plane tickets. So that is the intent of this, and the intent, of course, with a zero fiscal note, is that you and the Alaska legislature and Alaska State can help protect those Alaskans who are doing that good duty in other states, and because they are members of the National Guard in other states. So that is the intent, and thank you for bringing this forward, and I stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sansucci, and thanks for your advocacy. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Sansucci? Seeing none, thank you for making the time. And at this time, unless there's anyone in the room who wants to testify, I'm going to close public testimony. And I think that brings us back to the sponsor, maybe just to outline process. While I don't think it's a terribly controversial bill, and it got universal support in the previous committee referral, maybe hold it for today. And I guess it would be my hope to move it next committee hearing in a pretty perfunctory way to get it on its way, but want to return back to questions from the committee. Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Tuck, we have a very transient workforce up here, and so what about residents who work here, say a two-week on, two-week off schedule, but don't live here, don't reside here, and are members of a guard elsewhere? So does this apply to them? They can't come to work. They miss 2 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever the case may be. Would this be applicable to them as well? So protection, whether you're a resident here or not, is that is my question.
This is Representative Tuck through the chair. Yes, it does. It's their place of employment being in Alaska. So this is for Alaskan employers.
Any further questions from members of the committee on House Bill 3? Any further comments from the sponsor?
Just an additional comment. And the amendment was introduced in Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, and that included a new subsection under 3 to whereas reemployment rights for a member of the National Guard provides an exemption if the employer's circumstances have changed, making employment impossible and unreasonable, or the employment would impose any undue hardship on the employer. So we balance that between making sure that that a National Guard's person serving honorably their duty has the ability to return, but that it doesn't also create any hardship on the employer at the same time.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Tuck, for this good piece of legislation. And barring further thoughts from the committee, that's our last agenda item and point of business. We have a finance subcommittee at 4:30 p.m. The next standing policy committee meeting is Thursday, February 16th at 3 p.m. in this room. And I'd like to note on Thursday we will be hearing House Bill 20 relating to marriage solemnization, and House Concurrent Resolution 5 from Representative Eastman relating to Committee on Committees membership, and also hoping to bring this bill back forward and I hope move from committee. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Representative Tuck. And we're adjourned at 4:02 p.m.